So here we are, after 4 days of conferring and visiting Florence, and yes, and my task now is to, I've been told, to sum things up. This is a daunting task, especially considering the time allowed, and also considering that all of us are kind of at the end of our rope of sitting and listening to people. But I'll do my best with all your best wishes. We've had a very rich series of presentations, bringing what we might call a wide spectrum of light onto our theme. We want to use some imagery. What is our theme again? Getting back to starting point, transmitting the truth, education, preaching, and conversion in ISKCON. If my task is to summarize, then, and I don't know about the etymology here, but the thought of mathematics and making a sum comes to mind, that one adds things up. And here I might be disappointing because I think to add all of what's been spoken into a short sort of message where we can all say, yes, that's actually what we were all trying to say, is not in the books. But rather I will try to revisit one after another each of the presentations and beg for apologies from all of our presenters if I'm, missing what you felt was the essential point of what you wanted to say. Maybe you can stop me and say, no, that wasn't it at all. I should mention also that as we've heard, the presenters, whoever will still be with us, and the ISKCON Studies Institute organizers are coming together for one more session of, I guess we can call it reflection and perhaps also summarization, something in the form of some crystallization may come out of it. But I think that's not really my task now, but really just helping us. My experience in conferences is things tend to become something of a blur after a while. So many great ideas, but you ask after it was all over, so what was concluded? I don't know. So this is perhaps just a little aid for us to, in memory, a bit of smarring, if you like. First of all, Professor Barbara Holdridge, who had to go, I believe, to attend to a conference call, a scheduled conference call, spoke on Jiva Goswami. She always spoke of Goswami, so I'll use that as well. Although I could say Goswami because now she's not here. As a teacher of bhakti practice, and this was for me striking that she really highlighted what is, I think we could say, a mapping process or a mapping out of the path, specifically of raga nuga sadhana bhakti, which we don't hear so much about in ISKCON, and therefore all the more significant for us to hear that this mapping process has been done, specifically as a path which can be followed not only by the rishis, but by others. This was one of the points that she made, is that Jiva specifically says this. This is something that can be done, and that's why he's writing about it. It's something which can be followed. It's a high aiming path to nothing less than Goloka Dham, offering direct synesthetic experience, anubhava, of Krishna, By a methodical, progressive process, the teacher's meditation on Krishna in the Dhamma. And she highlighted how Jiva Goswami is taking other traditions, incorporating, might not be the appropriate word, yoga tradition, tantra tradition, bringing those to bear in the practices of the Vaishnava, and then taking those, the essential, the necessary step, the significant step further to what makes the practice Vaishnava as opposed to tantra or yoga. So in terms of preaching, I think it's significant that Jiva is making it a process of integration. We've been thinking about this notion of preaching along with teaching, and it seems to me that Jiva Goswami is one of our early models for this. He is taking other traditions, he is integrating them, he's incorporating them, yoga and tantra. And of course, he's not leaving them at that, he's not getting lost in them, he is establishing very clearly bhakti as his conclusion, he's asserting bhakti understanding, which is emphasizing the distinction between the devotee and Krishna. For me, a question has always been with respect to the six Goswamis, for whom were they in their time consciously writing? I've often wondered that as we claim that we are following them. In the 16th century, who did they actually have in mind? It's of course nice to think that they were anticipating that their teachings would be spread around the world, that Russians, Germans, English, American, Polish, Italian, etc. would be seriously studying their works. But I personally, maybe in my sometimes historian persona, sort of wonder what they were thinking at that time. Who are actually going to read my books, my Sanskrit literature? Who was their audience? Then, well, that's how I want to sort of go through one after another of the presentations. Next we heard from Dr. Pranava Das, newly Dr. Pranava Prabhu, preaching conversion or education, the case of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. We're moving up in history with Bhaktisiddhanta to, of course, the guru of Srila Prabhupada, and his history, his life, has not been so carefully studied. Some of you know there is almost simultaneously appearing with Pranava's study, another study done by His Holiness Bhaktivikas Swami, which he explicitly states in the beginning, in his introduction, this is a hagiography. I am writing a hagiography. It's a very carefully studied hagiography, but he understands that that's what he's doing. Pranava has considered Bhaktisiddhanta in the context of these rubrics, or the other way around, the rubrics in the context of Bhaktisiddhanta. Preaching, he says, is essentially religious communication and can be sharing. Of course, the word bhakti is sometimes translated as something like sharing. Education, he spoke of in terms of theoretical and practical points of bhakti, and we heard a lot about the practical application of education that he saw. And then conversion, he speaks of in terms of a change of heart. And we heard about Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur's experience, his own experience of transformation, going through a liminal state, a state of uncertainty, to a change of lifestyle. So conversion as passing through into a change of lifestyle, which in the case of Bhaktisiddhanta was a quite profound experience in the encounter with his guru, Gaurakishore Das Bhavani. Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur, we heard, was extremely context sensitive in his preaching and education. A couple of things that were striking to me was one, Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur's development and concern to develop relationships with Muslims in Mayapur. I think this is something that the present Mayapur project maybe needs to be reminded of. And the second point was his mode of sharing in the context of presenting his message in the West, the idea of sharing his message rather than somehow either forcing or digvijayiing, that idea I mentioned in the beginning. At the end, Prabhupada suggested for ISKCON, and here I'll simply quote, "It is important for ISKCON in the West to explore new modern approaches to its monastic and lay communities that allow it to increase its presence and impact in the Western mainstream, perhaps through Western academic or theological education and or popular forms of practice such as yoga, leading to, but not necessarily exclusive, conversion." I feel that I'm leaving something out here, but indeed, that's what I'm also being asked to do, is leave a lot out. So, we move on to newly Dr. Rember Lutya Harms Gopinatha Charyadas and his discussion in Good Faith on the meaning and role of Shraddha in Chaitanya Vaishnava thought. And here I thought we had an interesting example of what Indologists tend to do, or philologists, or Indologist philologists. We focus on one single word, namely Shraddha, to explore just exactly how the word is used in the Bhagavatam, the Bhagavata Purana, with a question in mind, and that is, are we using this word today in the same way that the word is used in the tradition as represented by this very central text? His conclusion is basically no, we are not, for the most part, using it that way. There is a sense of misunderstanding that may have important implications for our mission, for our preaching, for idea of conversion. He argues that Shraddha is neither a faith in dogma, nor is it a relational faith in a person. Specifically, he had numbers, the vast majority of the use of the term is in the instrumental, and therefore it's connected to doing something. So it becomes a faith in a certain practice. He mentions, toward the end of his presentation, Bhaktivinoda. He looked not only at the use of the text, of the word in the text, but also how commentators are using it. And he came to the near present, the recent history of our tradition with Bhaktivinoda Thakur, to say that faith is faith in the practices taught in scripture. That, I believe, kind of sums up the understanding. I had a couple of questions which there wasn't time to bring up, and I just will raise the question and not ask for an answer. That was Bhagavata Purana. Bhagavad Gita we also consider important in our tradition, and in the Bhagavad Gita in chapter 17 we encounter the statement Shraddha Mayo Yam Purusho Yo Yam Shraddha Sa Eva Sa, that the self is constituted above Shraddha. Shraddha Maya is full of Shraddha, which then manifests in different gunas. That's the topic of that chapter. So I would have been curious how that relates to the argument made. And then also Ado Shraddha. This is what we always hear that Rupa Goswami is saying, in the beginning there must be faith. And we seem to understand in ISKCON that faith needs to be developed through all of the stages that Rupa Goswami lists. And so then, what would the implication be with respect to this, I don't want to say new understanding, old understanding of faith as faith in practices taught in scripture. Then, I'm happy that Dr. Jan Olav Bengtsson is not present, because I may have missed his point. And so that would be annoying to him. But his presentation is a brilliant presentation, Conversion, Preaching, and Western Cultural Identity. Takes us on a challenging, what I would call, archaeological excursion into the realm of the history of ideas in order to question assumptions within ISKCON about appropriate approaches to conversion and preaching. A quote from him, which struck me, religious movements never survive long as transcendental bubbles. Adaptations happen, they are inevitable. Maybe not a terribly controversial point for all of us present here, but it seems indeed controversial to many who are not present here within the sphere, the bubble of ISKCON. The idea, again quoting, that any other identity hyphen or slash attachment than spirit, soul, servant of Krishna should be removed immediately is a fanaticism that is deeply problematic. Okay, that's interesting, and maybe that needs to be discussed. There wasn't really time to discuss it, but yes, provocative. And I think I'll jump. He explored different possibilities of integration, and essentially I would say gave warnings that if you want to be involved in the modern academy, if you want to be involved in interfaith dialogue, if you want to be involved in the New Age movement, beware, know what the traps are, know what the philosophical agendas are within these spheres of discourse. And another quote from him, Vedic tradition is broad and deep. ISKCON is only a small part of it. Integration will go on. If ISKCON is going to take part and lead in this process, it must undertake more conscious cultural integration. So I think that's his call for consciousness, Krishna conscious cultural integration has to be done intelligently. If one is not to end up with something other than one intended to. Next we have Dr. Nick Sutton, Educational Perspectives from the Mahabharata. We got lots of lively insights into what and how the Mahabharata teaches, recognizing he wanted to point out or remind us that the Mahabharata is a sacred text within religious communities. On that basis, then, it becomes possible to get some sense of how the Mahabharata specifically, and by implication more broadly, that body of literature, which I never know what to call anymore, because if we call it Vedic, then we have problems depending on who is hearing. But in any case, understanding the modus operandi of the Mahabharata, he argues, helps us to understand how the tradition which we represent, which we practice, can more effectively be brought to bear in the world today, can be appreciated as a set of tools which can then be worked with for leading responsible lives. He says, Mahabharata is a spiritual resource that can be taken or left. One can take one part and leave the rest. It is a resource for one's spiritual life. To internalize the teaching is the aim. And then he explained how, in his experience, this is being done in the teaching of, well, based in the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies, the continuing education programs, and how Hindus, real people of today, actually interact with their scriptures as they're finding out what their scriptures are, is actually quite dynamic. And he wants to say that this is really preaching. Again, quoting, the OCHS, like the Mahabharata, offers resources showing what people can be, and in this way it is preaching. Think about what you have heard, then decide what you want to do. Then we have Dr. To Be, Kumari Priyadasi. It's actually quite nice. I was just becoming aware this morning that we have three doctoral candidates have given presentations, and we have two new doctors with us. So speaking in terms of connection with the established the Western Secular Academy, we have quite something going on in that respect, and I think it's nice. Promising, hopeful. Kumari Priya, the meaning and form of conversion in Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition. Kumari Priya showed us how complicated the word conversion is. Showing some history, I found intriguing her examples of Indian Islamic traditions, Muslims of Bengal and Ismailis of Rajasthan, which I knew absolutely nothing about, and now I know something about. As a way of showing the complexity of this issue, she surveyed meanings in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, essentially giving two categories, theological and emotional experience. I would suggest here one might also explore the account of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself as a conversion narrative, that he goes, meets Ishvara Puri, he comes back a Hare Krishna. In profound translation, one might even say that that narrative begins there and ends with his taking sannyas as part of that conversion narrative. Or, as I was suggesting before, it's actually about a kind of ongoing and eternal conversion. You mentioned Bhakti Siddhanta Thakur saying, in the ultimate sense, there is no conversion, there is really rather an uncovering of the eternal self. And then, in that context, an interesting comment from Radhanand Swami, that the greatest need is conversion within this time. So a sense that what is the substance of conversion, if we need to use that term, and I think Virabhadra is raising the question whether that's a good term at all, considering that it really arises out of institution. If there is a need for that term, the sense within the tradition is it has to do with some substance, not simply form. There seems to be an ever-present tension between the two. Then we had Hrivaye Chargonya, as I learned to pronounce his name this morning from him. Conversion, experience, and narrative examples from his poem. Here, it's interesting that we have a study done of real people in his poem. What are they saying about these subjects? What is their experience? His concern is religious experience, essentially. And so he focused on that in terms of conversion, and indeed his narratives, we could say, are very much about some change, preparing for some change, and then, as he put it, preparation and then decision. So he gave an overview of the history of Iskan Croatia, where his focus is, Iskan Zagreb, stressing that context is important or essential in considering conversion and conversion narratives. And then he wants to say something like, if I got it right, conversion of an individual cannot be separated from conversion of the institution. So the idea of an institution converting, I think, is curious, interesting, and yes, why not? Let's consider further about that. He brought in some theory from one Louis Rambo to conceptualize his research, basically to say that there are many aspects of conversion: context, crisis, quest, encounter, interaction, commitment, and consequence. And this, he says, helped him very much to understand what was going on with the narratives that he gave. Some samples he gave us, one Madayanti, and these were pseudonyms he was giving. I figured this out because one of the names he was giving, when I heard the description of him, because I know some of these people, I understood, no, that's so-and-so. He's talking about somebody with a different name. I was struck by the examples he gave. A mother with a young child came to the point of, quote, no longer worrying about how to make ends meet. So this is, you know, an issue of how do I manage my life in real terms of paying the bills, and then coming to a point, Krishna. Krishna will solve it. A kind of conversion. As has come to be called Sankirtan devotee. That wasn't a term ever used in Prabhupada's time. Sankirtan is a training ground, I thought this was interesting, for, quote, exploring one's newfound identity. And then one example of a devotee saying, I would look in the mirror to check if this is still me. I would lose my sense of identity, me as myself. That doesn't sound like Jiva Goswami. But anyway, whenever this happened, people would buy many books. So maybe we have to lose our identity in order to sell more books. Anyway, interesting expression of what must have been a reasonably profound experience of transformation, conversion, if you like. Okay, he talked about also habitus, the idea of Pierre Girardot, emphasizing the idea of process of conversion. And I'll just mention a response to Gopinathacharya's comment about syncretism and breach. And relating to Jan Olaf's presentation, he said, yes, people keep something of their previous orientation. Conversion in ISKCON is not a fusion, nor is it a break with previous affiliations. So continuity is there. We might say it's been said of sociology of religion that it's simply slow journalism. We already know what what people think, and then somebody goes and surveys. I can say that also because Remo is no longer here. No. Anyway. Then we have Dr. Edith Best, Urmila Dasi, Enculturation, the Relationship Between Spirituality and Culture Applied to Education. And I'm seeing the clock tick. I have 2 more minutes according to the clock. I hope I get a little more time. Or is everybody's stomach growling too much? Okay, we're approaching the end. She began with a definition of culture in neutral terms as how one embodies one's ideals, gave some examples of that, and called attention to areas of educational culture, which she went through very quickly. And then she focused on 2 types of culture, native and alien. Native to a religion, alien to a religion. And this led to a discussion of possible relationships between a religion and an alien culture, basically 3. One she calls exclusive aggressive, where I was wondering, can it be exclusive without being aggressive? Relativistic syncretistic, and then inclusive dialogic. And then she gave results of taking either of these 3 stances, results positive, results negative. It may sound good to be exclusive, but then what's going to be the cost? There will be a price to that. There will be a consequence. And the same with each of these options. And then she added this perspective from, I guess, business culture regarding notions of closed, porous, and flexible organizations, concluding that as we, individually or collectively, make decisions about how to relate ourselves in a given culture, wherever we are, we can be conscious of what sort of decisions we are making. And I would just suggest this in itself may be indeed the process of education, where we are looking, we saw here statement on education, we may be looking toward having the capacity to make such decision intelligently, being guided by understanding such as she has suggested in this presentation. Yes. I'm going a little more quickly through now because also we're into the present day, so you can more easily remember what was spoken. Oh, but I do want to back up for a moment and say that we did get a very nice seminar from our historian of late medieval architecture yesterday. Now we know something about how Brunelleschi, is that how you pronounce?
Brunelleschi.
Yes, how he brought all that stone up onto that roof. Yes, there may be wonderful applications of that. I thought about it. It's significant because this is a religious building that was being constructed over, how many years did it take to build the whole thing? The whole thing.
I thought it was important that Oxen, the father of religion, built that.
Who?
The Oxen.
Oh, the Oxen. Ah, there you go. But how many years did it take to build on?
The tower, well, it was started in 1300 in the cathedral. The tower was started around 1400s.
Okay, 100 years.
I think about 50, 60, 70 years.
So 160, 170 years. Yeah. So we tend to want things, you know, quick. We want quick results, but in earlier times, the thinking process was different, that we can do things which will have lasting effect over so many future generations. And I suppose we can say that's what, in some sense, what we are about in such a conference as this. Then we have Krishnadas Kaviraj speaking on philosophical interfaith dialogue for lay people. Again, a study with real people in the real world today, which was a fascinating, first of all, reflection on the theory of interfaith dialogue. I've myself looked a little bit at, I suppose many of us have, looked at interfaith dialogue in practice and theory, and maybe felt some dissatisfaction with it. And so this presentation of the Walk in My Shoes program, I think, was very, very interesting, with indeed possible implications for us as we consider preaching and conversion and indeed education, and maybe what we want to think about based on the idea that Krishnadas has developed, is how interfaith dialogue could be shaped as a process of education rather than, or more in the sense of education than in the sense of preaching and conversion. Let's see, particulars on this. Let me just jump to what I've underlined. He says, he has taken from one of two early interfaith dialoguers, namely Jean Baudin, with his emphasis on performance rather than content, with a concern for criteria for discussion of truth, taking coherence, plausibility, authority, integrity, and what works as factors in the judging of truth. And so he has said that he wants to focus on these. Actually, I was a little confused on this, because it seemed to be on the one side he wanted to hold back any discussion of truth altogether, put it aside, we're just going to dialogue. But he is concerned about criteria of truth. I guess I was a bit reassured when hearing the feedback, some of the samples he gave of the feedback. I was going to ask if there were any who, as their feedback, said, you know, this whole program was just actually, for me, a waste of time, didn't give me anything. We got lots of positive feedback. So it was all positive. Well, that's good.
Nine people dropped out
for them, yeah. And he called attention, one of the responses had to do with not being judged, and he called attention that this could be a point of relevance for ISKCON. Negotiation of one's own faith, this is something which we don't have so much of a forum for within ISKCON. We have lots of forums for, preaching and so on. But where's the forum for discussing doubt? It's there. It's as Sachin Anand Swami said, things are discussed in the hallways. But are there forums? Are there venues for discussing doubt in a way which allows for discussion without being judged. And then he spoke of the value of the Walk in My Shoes program. And And here he talked about the concept of maturity, and he mentioned a few resources, a few theories of maturity. This is scholars for you. They need to, you know, exactly say what is maturity. I thought this is interesting, but certainly the term in itself, without all the definitions, is, I think, useful for us to think in terms of education, in terms of preaching, and in terms of conversion. Finally, the relevance for ISKCON, the question was there. Let's see. There's a difference between the dominant discourse and what goes on in people's lives. If such a program could be facilitated within the institution, this could be helpful. I think this idea came up. Yes. And then we had our panel discussion, and I think I'll not try to summarize that because time has passed and we all heard it recently. I think it was a good start. I'll just say it was a nice start in what's really a very big discussion, and one might say it's part of the subtext almost of all of our conferences, is that these questions are there about the relation of the academy and or academic learning and Vaishnava learning. So I think that's just part of an ongoing discussion. And then finally we had none other than Shonaka Rishi Das, the future of education in ISKCON, giving us the strategy document in its present incarnation, the strategy document for ISKCON education. He emphasized that it has to be short, and it has to be clear, and indeed, it has to be like a strategy document, not tactics, not something else. It can be elaborated through some, and should be elaborated through so many papers, so many writings, purports, commentary, and that is actually an ongoing process, but we might say also location-specific. So a document in one place may not be so relevant as a document in another place elaborating one particular aspect or all aspects of the strategy document as a whole. So, there we have it. That's what we all heard. And I think the question before us is whether we feel enriched from all of this discussion, whether we feel challenged by all of this discussion with respect to the themes that we've chosen for this topic, whether we feel that what we're doing here as a whole is having a purpose, a significant purpose. I certainly feel it does, and I hope everyone else does. I think, in a sense, the medium is the message. The message of our conference is as a whole is that there should be such conferences. And it's kind of as simple as that. What I would like to see is more people attending conferences. And so we might want to think about how more people could come. It's wonderful that those of you who have come. And I want to personally thank everyone who has participated, who has made it possible, especially the Villa Vrindavan Yatra. I want to, on behalf, I can say personally, and on behalf of the ISKCON Studies Institute, I want to thank for all of the making possible, making comfortable, making pleasant, making ecstatic, making prasadam filling, and all these wonderful things. Yes, it's almost like. Almost like Villa Vrindavan is becoming a second home. We feel very much at home here. And I want to thank all the presenters for being so presented for being so dynamic and thought-provoking and substantial. Having, that was terrible. Having such substance for us to hear. And who am I missing? And the ISKCON Studies Institute members, all of you, for especially Lal Krishna Prabhu, for celebrating. It's a birthday. We won't sing the song again. We won't sing.
But he does want chocolate.
Yeah, we figured that out. Well, you're not going to get chocolate just now. That could come later, but now it's going to be pizza. So pizza will do. All right, I think we'll end with that. Thank you all very much indeed. And I think it's safe and appropriate to say, Srila Prabhupada.
Jai!